Hello, and welcome to Literally from the North Shore. Thank you for tuning in. Today, we will continue with Tom Kohler's reading of Minnesota author Dean Hovey's book, Whistling Pines, a lighthearted mystery set in a fictional Two Harbors senior care facility. We'll pick up where Tom left off last time.
Whistling Pines, Chapter 5. I hesitated for a half second when I opened Gary's door to leave. I'm not sure if I heard the whine of the electric motors or if I had a premonition of impending peril, but that hesitation saved me from a collision with two drag racers who flashed past the door, nearly rang over the toes of my shoes. "Look out, Pete!" Elton Nielsen yelled a second after he'd passed, driving his blue Hurricane electric scooter. Elton owned Nielsen Brothers clothing store and had never been seen in anything but a suit. The residents often commented that he even wore a suit and Florsheim shoes when he cut his grass. Half a length behind him was Scooter Arneson, dressed in dicky blue work pants and a Minnesota Twins sweatshirt. He was racing his red Victor scooter, painted with yellow flames, and losing ground the further they got down the hallway. Scooter had been a legendary hot rod racer and heavy drinker. He'd reportedly called the fire chief at home late one evening to announce that his supper was on fire. When the fire chief asked why Scooter hadn't dialed 911, he responded that he thought maybe the chief could bring over a squirt hose and take care of it without waking up all the volunteers. "Guys, stop before you kill someone," I yelled after them. Scooter slowed and just missed colliding with a small table that a vase and flowers were still wobbling on after the close call. "I want a rematch," he yelled at Elton, who'd disappeared around the corner. "Hey, Scooter," I said, catching up with him before he could continue his chase. "Hold up for a second." I was just getting my scooter into the steep part of the power curve. Another 50 feet and I would have left him in my dust. "I don't think you guys should be racing in the hallways. Someone's going to get hurt." "Pete, you're such a killjoy." I was just talking to Gary Sheeta, and he had some pretty sad stories about Axel and things that he'd done to people. Red worries about that kind of stuff. I didn't spend much time dwelling on it. It tended to make me sad, and I didn't like being a sad drunk. "What did you think of Axel?" Scooter snorted. "Axel owned a couple of bars, and I wasn't a patron." "Was there a special reason?" "Most places get to know you, and they'll let you have a little credit to carry you over until payday. They'll pass you a free beer now and again. Well, at Axel's places, it was cash on the barrelhead, no credit, and there wasn't a free kernel of popcorn, much less a free Grain Belt beer. It didn't make me want to hang around." Both Scooter and Elton were nearly helpless without their scooters and rarely took more than a few steps to get from their scooters to chairs. I mentally scratched them from the list of possible suspects. Whistling Pines, Chapter 6. I don't really live outside of town, but the housing thins quickly as you get a few blocks from the downtown stoplights. I looped past the row of Norway pines lining Highway 61 along the Two Harbors Golf Course and Curling Club. I don't believe that combination of sports are housed in one facility anywhere outside of Two Harbors, but considering the mix of seasons, the curling rink makes sense. In my view, both sports are an excuse for drinking. I've seen golfers putting while huge maize snowflakes swirl around them and drinking beer with chattering teeth. I like hanging out with the curling crews who prefer drinking scotch in a warm bar. I drove to Seagog, the little development where I lived, and was surprised to see an orange Lake County dump truck parked near my house where two workers dressed in their OSHA-required lime green, orange, and reflective white vests held a signpost. Dolores, my elderly neighbor, was leaning on her cane, obviously giving the county guys a piece of her mind. I was tempted to drive past and duck into my garage, pretending to ignore the situation, but I'd been an Eagle Scout and I had the ongoing curse of needing to do a daily good deed. I eased behind the truck and saw a look of desperation from the county workers. "What's up?" I asked as I approached the threesome. Dolores was dressed in a flowered house dress and orthopedic shoes. Her hair had been a variety of colors over the years, and the current odd shade of lilac matched the flowers in her house dress. "Peter, I'm so glad you're here," she said, disengaging herself from the two county workers. "You have to explain to these stubborn men that they can't set up a deer crossing here. You know that the deer are already wiping out my hostas. Having a deer crossing here would just make the situation unbearable." I looked at the man with Larry embroidered on his vest, and he pulled out a deer crossing sign from the back of the truck. I tried to explain that the deer already cross here. We're just putting up a sign to warn drivers. The other guy, Mike, according to his vest, was leaning on the new signpost. "We just want to put up the sign and go home for supper. They don't pay us enough to put up with crap like this." He kicked at a steel post driver that was lying at his feet. Dolores spun like a dervish and gave Mike a glare that could have melted the post driver. "I don't much appreciate cuss words," she punctuated her comments by wagging her cane ominously. Mike was turning red and Larry was in full grimace. I could see the situation degenerating quickly, mostly because Dolores was about to assault two county workers. "Larry, does the sign have to go right here?" I asked. The county engineer consulted with the Department of Natural Resources, and they put this orange spot where the sign is supposed to go. Larry poked his toe at a small spot of orange spray paint on the grass. "What happens to the orange paint when you drive the post?" I asked. Mike shrugged. "I guess it kind of goes away. So what?" "I live in the next house, just across Mrs. Carvenan's driveway, and I would really like to have the deer cross in my yard." Larry and Mike looked at each other. Mike shrugged. He started scuffing at the orange spot. "Any place special you'd like them to cross?" Larry asked. I turned to Dolores and asked, "Wouldn't it be nice if they crossed by that maple tree?" She took a couple of steps to the side and made a visual survey of the boulevard in front of my house. "I think that the deer would really enjoy crossing there. That tree turns such pretty shades of red, orange, and yellow in the fall. I'm sure they'd love it." I nodded to Larry and steered Mrs. Carvenan to her front steps. Like all the houses on our street, the style was cookie-cutter bungalow built by the railroads during the Iron Range boom. We made it up the three concrete steps and through the creaking storm door. Her small porch had a pair of white-painted wicker chairs flanking a matching table. Given the regular winds that blow off Lake Superior, there weren't a lot of opportunities to sip iced tea on the porch, but this grouping was ready for service on the rare 80-degree days we have each summer. "Dolores, I think you were kind of tough on those nice county workers." In the background, I could hear the clang of the post driver. "They're nice guys who are just trying to do their jobs." "Oh, Peter, you are so naive. I learned a long time ago that if you don't look out for your own interests, people will roll right over you. I learned that lesson from my husband, and that policy has served me well." By the time I got back to my car, the sign project was complete, and the guys were pulling away. Larry waved. Mike just shook his head. Whistling Pines, Chapter 7. Tuesday morning broke colder but clear. I stepped onto the front step to pick up the newspaper and saw that the Honda's windshield was covered with a thick layer of frost. I made a mental note to leave 10 minutes early because I'd have to scrape. I poured myself a bowl of Rice Krispies and was retrieving the milk when I remembered that it hadn't passed a smell test 2 days before. My reluctance to go with the milk was reinforced when I poured it down the drink and noted the lumps. Plan B was a move to instant oatmeal. The variety pack had been cleared of all my favorites, which left me with the peaches and cream with the little orange bits that tended to be either as chewy as wood chips or as slimy as leeches. As the water heated in the microwave, I noted that Axel's murder earned the front page headline of the Lake County News Chronicle. The article said that it was the first murder in Two Harbors since the 1940s and declined to name the victim pending notification of the next of kin. I looked at the other news headlines and saw that the Great Lakes inaugural cruise ship season had been interrupted by an outbreak of the extremely contagious Norwalk virus among the passengers. I had a mental image of dozens of people confined to their tiny staterooms with cramps and other stomach disorders that I didn't want to dwell upon. The Great Lakes Queen was docked in Thunder Bay, Ontario, where the ship was being decontaminated and where several of the passengers were hospitalized. The final paragraph riveted my attention when it mentioned that the ship had docked in Duluth on Sunday, and city health officials had notified the local clinics and emergency rooms to watch for cases to show up after the 5 to 8 day incubation period. Norwalk virus is miserable in healthy people, but is often deadly in people with poor health and senior citizens. God, I hope that doesn't make its way to Two Harbors, I thought, making a mental note to mention the article to Jenny. Stomach illnesses tend to go through senior residences like wildfires through a dry pine forest. I had an unsettling thought about Stella Ahonen's birthday party, recalling the Finnish visitors who'd come to Duluth on the cruise ship. The beeper on the microwave snapped me back to my breakfast tasks and preparations for work. The BCA's Winnebago was gone from the parking lot, making me hopeful that life might be returning to near normal. I picked up the newspapers from the front sidewalk as I walked in. The Duluth News Tribune and the St. Paul Pioneer Press both splashed headlines about the murder in a Two Harbors assisted living center. I drafted April's activities calendar and slipped a copy of it into the director's mail slot for approval. Most of it was repetitive. Daily current events discussions, Sunday chapel services, Catholic at 10 and Lutheran at 11, and afternoon popcorn and movies, Tuesday trip to Shopko, Wednesday bingo, Thursday afternoon trip to Betty's Pies, and Saturday evening card games in the activity room. I penciled in a sing-along for 2 Fridays and a book club reading for the other 2. Mondays were my day off, and I left them all open. I put a post-it note on my desk with a reminder to call Duluth about a harbor tour package on the Vista Queen later in the summer. The residents were starting to migrate into the dining room for breakfast as I ducked into the kitchen for a cup of coffee and to check on the latest rumors making their way through the halls. Miriam Millam almost knocked me down as she erupted through the kitchen doors carrying a platter of French toast. "Dang it, Pete," she uttered as she tried to keep all the food on the platter. "You are going in the outdoor. Use the indoor to go in and the outdoor to go out." She quickly composed herself and presented the platter to the first table with a smile. Miriam was a sturdy farm woman who almost always had a smile. She and her husband owned a dairy farm where she worked 8-hour days milking cows and tending to the calves, bracketing an 8-hour day in Whistling Pines kitchen. I was amazed by her energy and her compassion. If anyone was sick or having a tough time, Miriam had a get-well card for us to sign, and she was the one who showed up at their doorstop with a hamburger noodle hot dish, the Minnesota version of a casserole. The washing crew was scrubbing and clattering pots and pans as I drew a mug of coffee from the urn. I watched the rhythm of the workers as pancake batter and eggs turned into meals going out the door, followed by the pots moving back to the stainless steel sinks and dishwashers. I took a Honeycrisp apple from a bowl and bit into the tart fruit with a snap. I wasn't part of the flow, and the workers ignored me as if I were wallpaper as long as I stayed out of the way. Two high school-age girls flew into the kitchen through the indoor and were tittering about someone's date the previous night. Miriam followed behind with an empty platter that she set on the edge of the sink. "I hear they found a stash of $100 bills in Axel's room," Miriam said as she drew a cup of coffee. She took a sip and stared at me over the rim, waiting for a response. I hadn't heard that. "But the police chief deputized you as an investigator," she said with a sly smile. "I'd think that you'd be the first person to know something like that." "Yep. You'd think that. Someone who was an investigator would know that. I guess that must mean I'm not a deputy investigator." "Either that, or there wasn't any money," she said. "Or I can't reveal information to Snoops about an ongoing investigation." "Touché," she said, raising her cup in a mock toast. "Is that the only rumor this morning?" I asked. "Yesterday there were comments about Axel sleeping around before an appropriate grieving period had passed." "I heard that they're having bagpipes at the funeral." "Bagpipes?" I asked, stopping my coffee cup halfway to my mouth. "Axel was Swedish." "Hey," she said defensively, "you asked what rumors I'd heard, and that's what I've heard." She paused and gave me the evil eye. "If you're not investigating, why are you so interested in the rumors?" "I just want to know what's going around. It's easier to keep a lid on things if I can head off the rumors before they get out of hand." "Rumors have a life of their own," Miriam said with a snort. "There's no way to head them off. The pity is that things sometimes become what people think they are, and no amount of fact or truth can turn back the tide. They're a bunch of people with too much time on their hands and too much time alone. They keep mulling things over, and without a sounding board, they start to believe something that's not really reasonable." "Hazel Perkins said that Axel was in a romantic relationship with someone. Have you heard anything about the object of his affections?" I asked. Miriam stiffened visibly. "I can't imagine a woman having 1 second for Axel." "Your body language is saying a lot. I take it that you had a negative experience with him." "He liked to rub up against the female staff, and he got a little handy at times."
"Handy?
Peter, how naive are you?" she asked, shaking her head. "He'd steady himself with a hand on my lower back, and then it would slide down. I'd be serving a table behind him, and he'd push his chair back, and I'd feel a hand on my thigh. Do you remember when he wore the elastic brace on his wrist for a couple of weeks?" "That was about 2 years ago, just after I started at Whistling Pines," I said. "I pulled his hand off my butt in a way that discouraged him from doing it again." "I assume that you're not the only one that Axel liked." "Axel liked all the girls, and he liked to tell us about all the money he had, like that would make us look at him as anything but a dirty old man." "Hey, do you need a dog on the farm?" "No farmer needs another dog," she replied, eyeing me suspiciously. "Why do you ask?" "I was just thinking that Tucker needs a home." Miriam took a deep breath and then let out a sigh. "We don't need another dog, but Tucker's a nice dog. Don't have him put down or anything, but don't put me at the top of the list of possible new owners." Whistling Pines, Chapter 8. Toivo, snuffy, sorry, shuffled into the dining room and chose an empty table. He always wore flannel shirts and khaki pants, and the right rear pocket of every pair of pants was nearly worn through by the can of Copenhagen chewing tobacco he carried there. He had snow-white hair and a scraggly beard stained yellow and speckled with little bits of tobacco. His gums were nearly black from years of tobacco use. I drew a cup of coffee from the urn and carried it to him with a stainless steel pitcher of half and half.
"Thanks, Peter," he said in his deep Finnish accent, as he poured enough cream in his cup to raise the cholesterol of the entire town of Two Harbors. I was amazed at how slender he was, considering the cream, butter, and whole milk he consumed at every meal. He often came to the dining room late, when most of the residents had already eaten. Most times he chose a table where he could be alone. When I sat down, he grimaced. "May I join you?" "Looks like you already have," he replied, slurping down some coffee and then staring into his cup. "Did you hear that Axel died?"
"Yep."
He drank some more coffee and pulled a blue bandana from his pocket, making a show of shaking it open before blowing his nose with a sound that resembled a goose honking. He carefully folded the bandana and put it back in his pocket before returning to his coffee. The silence dragged on for what seemed like a full minute as Snuffy drank coffee and I watched. "It doesn't seem like many people liked him," I said, trying to leave an opening for expanded conversation.
"Nope."
"Tell me about your experience with Axel." Snuffy squirmed in his chair.
"Weren't any," he replied, taking a sip of coffee.
"You must have crossed paths with him somewhere, didn't you?" I asked. Snuffy took a large gulp of coffee, then stood up. "Are you leaving so soon?" I asked.
"My show's on," he replied, shuffling away from the table.
I watched Snuffy walk away and pitied him for his lonely existence. He had chosen to be so isolated from the rest of the residents that he probably had never been crossed by Axel. Wendy Plauda was sitting at the next table working on her daily attempt at the New York Times crossword puzzle. Behind her, two of the residents were in the middle of a cribbage game, and beyond them, Jingle, the maintenance man, was changing a fluorescent light. Wendy was officially the assistant director and acted as a liaison between the residents and anyone on the outside, from Medicare to county assistants and funeral homes. In addition to those responsibilities, she sang in a duet with me when we put on music, filled in during the director's vacation, repaired and debugged our computer network, and even helped the aides when they were in a crunch. She had a round face with a Cheshire cat grin that made me think she was about to cause trouble. When Toivo left, Wendy motioned for me to join her. "Snuffy's a man of few words," she said. "Have you ever noticed his gums? They're so black they remind me of a buzzard's mouth."
"Does he have any friends?"
Wendy tapped her pencil on the puzzle a couple of times. "Most times he avoids people. He'll sit on the fringes of a group, but if anyone tries to engage him, he leaves. I think he spends most of his time in his room watching television or polishing his old car." "That seems like a lonely existence," I mused. "I suppose he's always been really quiet. He never married, and if you're not social, you don't accumulate friends either." Garrison Keeler was talking about Norwegian bachelor farmers on a prairie home companion, and he said, "Odds are good that the goods are odd." Wendy nodded. She looked down at her crossword and said, "I need an 8-letter word for cross that might end in X."
"Crucifix," I replied.
Wendy slapped her forehead and said, "Duh." Jingle was a wiry man, always dressed in blue work clothes and always on a mission. I walked over as he was moving his ladder to the next light fixture and watched as he expertly replaced the burned-out fluorescent bulbs. "What's up, Pete?" he asked as he moved the ladder to another fixture. "What do you know about Axel Olsen?"
Other than knowing that he's dead, you mean?
"What kind of a guy was he?" Jingle pushed back his Minnesota Twins cap and scratched at his thinning blonde hair. It struck me that he was probably old enough to be a resident. Well, he had me do stuff for him. I don't know more than that.
"Was he nice or grateful for what you did?"
Jingle shrugged. "I don't know about that. He never said thanks or anything, but most people don't.
Lots of them have me come to do things just so they have someone to talk with.
Was he ever mean to you?
Jingle's eyes sparked. No one is ever mean to me. He picked up the ladder and moved it to a new light fixture.
You see, if they're mean to me, nothing gets fixed.
People catch on to that quickly, and Axel was no fool, I thought to myself.
You've been listening to Episode 4 of Whistling Pines by Minnesota author Dean Hovey. There will be a total of 15 episodes in this reading, so be sure to tune in again next time for more from Whistling Pines. If you miss an episode during the reading of this book, you may find the previous week's episodes posted each weekend on our website, ktwh.org. Under the Programs tab, near the top of the homepage, just look for Literally from the North Shore on the drop-down menu under Programs.
In twilight glow I see blue eyes crying in the rain. When we kissed goodbye and parted, I knew we'd never meet again. Love is like a dying ember, and only memories remain. And through the ages I'll remember crying in the rain. In a land that knows no parting.